As I understood, Gavin kicked this off last week, but he told me he didn't get very far in his introduction to Vedanta, so I'll cover a bit of that, and then we'll talk a bit about Ramanuja. Ramanuja, for those of you that don't know, just a short preview, he's one of the most influential theologians from the south. He was from Tamil Nadu, and he was a Vedantist, a very prolific writer, a very complex writer actually, not a very particularly easy writer, but lots of very interesting ideas, an author I particularly like, and he's one of my favourites, and mainly because he was a favourite of many of my teachers, and so they passed his love, their love for him onto me. But also somebody who influenced really a lot of theological developments later on in the Indian traditions, not just his own school, but also other schools as well. So he's a figure that you can't dismiss lightly. Okay, now it's Hinduism too is kind of the continuation of Hinduism one, and I must say I haven't attended Gavin's classes last term, so he told me a bit of what he did. But if there's something unclear, something that I assume Gavin told you in the previous term that you have no clue about, please let me know and I can elaborate on it. The history of India and the religious history of India is often portrayed as you have the Vedas, and then there's urbanization that happens, you have the sort of renouncer movement that arises in the form of the Upanishads, in the form of Buddhism and Jainism, and then Buddhism and Jainism really take off, they become very strong. You have Ashoka, the emperor who converts to Buddhism, make Buddhism the state religion. You have a series of mainly foreign rulers who come into India through the north and who establish their dynasties and their kingdoms and so on, who are largely Buddhist in sort of conviction. And so you have this long period of the rise of Buddhism and the flourishing of Buddhism and Jainism, and then suddenly you have Shankara that comes along and says that, okay, here's the, let's put the Vedas back into the picture. This is often a way that the history of India has been portrayed, which is a bit of a caricature, and we'll try to nuance that a little bit here. But one thing that is true about it is that by the 4th century AD, you have a long series of Buddhist and Jain kingdoms that are thriving in India. And at sort of around the 3rd, 4th century BC, things start to change, and you get the establishment of very strong, politically very strong kingdoms that are ruled by people that we would call Hindus, by people that have sort of see themselves within the Vedic traditions very, very broadly conceived. And the most famous of those is the Gupta Empire, which occupies most of the north but kind of reaches a bit into central India. And in the south you have a series of empires as well that arise there, of the Pallavas, the Pandyas and so on, the Rashtrakutas, and that develop in the south. Very strong kingdoms, very strong politically, and with that comes a whole revival of Hindu forms of religion. With the Gupta Empire in the north particularly, you see the constructions of temples really takes off in this period. And intellectually, most of the action actually happens in the south. And so all the main teachers that we know of, except one, but all the main teachers that we know of from this period were all living in the south, were all from the south and spent most of their life in the south, even though they traveled to the north as well. Hindus, when they look back on the history, they often portray that you had this dark period of Buddhism and Jainism that takes over, and then Shankara comes along, and Shankara presents brings the attention of the people back to the Upanishads and to the Vedas, and sort of reestablishes a Hindu identity. That's not entirely true, actually. Probably the person that's a lot more influential in really placing the Veda and the authority of the Veda in the center of the religious life of many people is a person you perhaps have never heard of before. I think I can write on this, right?
I think it's left, the left
the other table.
Yeah. Okay. There's a person called Kumarila Bhatta, who is a Mimamsaka. Did Gavin say anything about Mimamsa? Okay. Mimamsa is a school of thought that develops over many centuries in India, and it's a school of thought. It's a theological school that is entirely concerned with the Vedas, and unlike Vedanta, which I'll speak about in a moment, which is concerned with the Upanishads, this is entirely, Mimamsa is purely concerned with the ritual performance of the that is prescribed in the Vedic texts, so Vedic rituals. And they develop a very complex ritual theology that's very interesting. But we won't have an awful lot. Maybe if you're interested in this, we could have a later class on Mimamsa. I kind of like Mimamsa. What Kumarila particularly was very influential in doing is he took on Buddhism intellectually in a way that hadn't been done before, at least not that we know. And he launches this immense attack on Buddhism and a very vigorous defense of the Vedic revelation. So large sections of his work are just dealing with the authority of the Veda, why the Veda is authoritative, and he develops very complex arguments for this. And so if there's anyone to be credited with the reintroduction of the Vedic text, if that's actually what happened, which I'm not sure it did, it's more Kumarila than Shankara, who actually did. The Shankara kind of comes along a century after Kumarila and does his job. Kumarila is very influential, very important, and anyway, we'll come back to Mimamsa in just a moment because it's important. But at the same time, this so-called dark period for Hindu thought is not really a dark period, because even though we do not have a lot of the works, none of these works survive, we do know that there was a lot of engagement in that period with the Vedic texts, with the Upanishads, with Vedic thought in various ways, and which is part of the, you know, we sort of, if you look at Kumarila and Shankara before them, you don't see a lot of big names there because we don't have their works anymore. And sort of in a sense, what we have, the history we know that we have of Hindu thought or Indian thought in general is kind of, what we have is the bestsellers list. It's, you know, everything is preserved in manuscripts. If a better text comes along on the same topic, the better text will be preserved and the other text will just disappear because nobody's interested in them. So what we have is the bestsellers list in a way. And even then, the bestsellers list often of a couple of centuries later. Mimamsa develops very strongly, and there's another school that gains in prominence in about the 8th century AD, which is sort of the sister school of this, which is the school of Vedanta. And Vedanta literally means the anta, the end word, the final word of the Veda. And it's a term that the Upanishads use for themselves to talk about themselves. Several of the Upanishads use this term to refer to themselves. And so the Upanishads, these texts, see themselves as the final word of the Vedic revelation. Traditionally, they're considered on the same level in a sense of to belong to the same category as the Vedic revelation. They're both Shruti, they're both considered unauthored, you know, to be apavrishaya, to not be of human origin. But the Upanishads see themselves as more than the Vedic revelation. They say what we teach is something that you won't find in these other Vedic texts, and ritual performance, which is the main topic of the other texts, is not the final word, but the final word is what we teach, which is knowledge of the akshara, of the imperishable, which is Brahman. And so Vedanta is a school, it's a term that is used to refer to the Upanishad, but it's also a term that is used to refer to the theological school that develops, that grows out of the Upanishads. And the Vedanta, its name is very significant for the school, because the entire concern of Vedanta is the meaning of the Upanishads. And you might have heard of the three sources of Vedanta. You have the first is the Upanishads. They have three foundational texts that they base their theology on. The first is the Upanishads. The second is the Bhagavad Gita, which is seen as the Upanishad of the Mahabharata, which is seen as the fifth Veda, so it's also an Upanishad. The Gita. I have funky G's. The Bhagavad Gita. And then the third text is the... the Brahma Sutras or the Vedanta Sutras. This is the same text, just two names for the same thing. And the Vedanta Sutras, if you read the Vedanta Sutras, it's basically a study of the Upanishads. The only thing that the Vedanta Sutra or the Brahma Sutra is trying to do is make sense of the Upanishads.
Explain.
It explains that, it lays down hermeneutical principles. This is how you have to read the Upanishad. This passage in the Upanishad means this, and so on. And it's constantly referring to the Upanishads. If you don't know the Upanishads, the Vedanta Sutra doesn't make any sense, basically. And so this is, you could say, a commentary on the Upanishads, a study of the Upanishad. And so you can see the Upanishads are central for Vedanta. It's all about the Upanishads. Even the Gita is seen as an Upanishad. And so for Vedanta, their main concern the Vedanta Sutra, the Brahma Sutra, start atato Brahma Vinyasa. Now then, the inquiry into Brahman. And so Brahman, what is Brahman? It becomes a central question for Vedanta. What is the origin of everything? What is the thing that underlies all existence? What is it that unites everything that there is? But they're a theological school in that they're dealing with these big questions, but they're really also, for them, theology and hermeneutics are not separate. Because then, you go a few sutras later into the text, and then Brahman is said to Shastra Yonitvad, because scripture, because the Upanishads are the yoni, or the womb of it, meaning scripture gives us knowledge of this. And so for them, doing theology means doing hermeneutics, means reading these texts and figuring out what these texts mean. They do not like independent reasoning. All Vedantic authors look down on independent reasoning, on just trying to philosophize and come up with answers to the big questions of life just by using reason. And they say, the Upanishads are the highest authority there, and therefore this is where we obtain our knowledge of Brahman. You'll find modern proponents of Vedanta stressing experience. Actually, classical Vedanta doesn't care so much about experience. You'll find modern exponents say that, it's about experience and whatever you experience, it's sort of Brahman can only be known by experience and these kind of things. Shankara does not talk at all about his own experience, and does not attach a lot of importance to experience when it comes to knowledge of Brahman. And all the other Vedantic authors too, they really downplay this. Now, the most prominent author the earliest prominent author that we know who writes a commentary on the Vedanta Sutra is Shankara, who lived in the, depending on who you ask, the 8th or the 9th century. And these are the three sources of Vedanta. Really, you have to add a fourth to it, and that is a commentary on this text, on the Brahma Sutras. Because the Brahma Sutras, they're sutras, and sutras are really concise texts. Traditionally, it's said if you write a sutra text and you can drop one syllable from a sutra, you experience the joy that you experience when your son is born. That's how they look at it. So you really try to condense everything, and so everything becomes very short, very concise, and they're sometimes very cryptic. And so you need commentaries in order to understand this. So you have a long tradition of commentaries on the Vedanta Sutra that are equally important, if not more important, than the text itself or the schools that develop from this. And so the oldest commentary that we still have is the one of Shankara. And he wrote a commentary on all three texts. So he wrote commentaries on the individual Upanishads, on the Bhagavad Gita, and a lengthy commentary on the Brahma Sutras. But we do know that there were commentaries before him. In fact, Ramanuja, before he starts writing his commentary, as we'll see in just a moment, he has heard of a commentary written by a person called Bodhayana, and he's looking for that. He wants to write his commentary only after he has read that commentary. And so he starts looking for that, for a manuscript that has this. And the story goes that he's traveling and he starts in Tamil Nadu where he lives. And in the end, he ends up all the way in Kashmir. He walked all the way to Kashmir with one of his friends. And finally in Kashmir, he finds some Brahmin who has a copy of that text. And the story then goes that the Brahmin says, you know, well, I can give you the text, but only for one night because I want it back tomorrow morning. And tradition says that Ramanuja and his friend, they memorize the whole text in one night and then go back to the south, and then Ramanuja starts writing his commentary. So we know there were commentaries before Shankara, but they just didn't survive. So it's not that Shankara is the first to do this, but it's just the others didn't survive. Now, in Shankara's time, which is 7th, 8th century AD, I mentioned this figure, Kumarila. He's coming up. He lived about a century before Shankara, but Mimamsa, he sort of gives new life to Mimamsa. Mimamsa is really growing, so you get this ritual theology that develops, and that is a force that you have to deal with if you're particularly if you're sort of a Hindu author, if you see yourself in the context of the Vedic revelation, you have to deal with Mimamsa. And so one of the central questions that arises in this period is what is the relationship between Mimamsa and Vedanta? And what is the relationship between ritual practice, which is the primary focus of Mimamsa, and knowledge of the Absolute, which is the primary focus of Vedanta? And every author on Vedanta in this period has to deal with this question, and they'll all deal with it differently. But in general, what every author will do, Vedantic author will do, is they will see themselves as merely a continuation of Mimamsa. And in fact, another name for Vedanta that the Vedantists use is the...
So you said that Mimamsa is a continuation of Vedanta?
No, the other way around. Vedantists sometimes call their school Uttara Mimamsa, the later Mimamsa. And then they call Mimamsa proper Purva Mimamsa, the earlier Mimamsa. Of course, the Mimamsakas don't like this because it implies, it's the same, you know, with Hinayana and Mahayana in Buddhism. The Hinayana Buddhists, the Theravada Buddhists, will not call themselves Hinayana because it implies that they're lesser And so this is a term that the Mimamsa Vedantists use. So they say, we're the Uttara Mimamsa, we're the later Mimamsa, and you guys, you're the Purva Mimamsa, you're the earlier Mimamsa. And so what you're doing is merely preliminary for what we're doing. And this is true in various ways. The most striking one is that Mimamsa is a very complex school. They build up a very elaborate system of thought that deals not just with, I mean, it's their main concern is ritual practice. But in order to get to ritual practice, they say, okay, well, how do we know what we have to do? How do we know what rituals we have to perform? Well, you have to read texts, you have to read the Vedic revelation. But how do we understand Vedic revelation? So they develop a whole philosophy of language that's fairly sophisticated. And they develop a whole theory of how ritual actually works and what the nature of the gods is and all that. And what basically happens is Vedanta is going to borrow this whole foundation that Mimamsa builds and just say, okay, fine, what you guys have done is really nice, thank you very much. You've laid a good foundation, you've laid down hermeneutical principles, a philosophy of language. We're going to use that framework, and instead of applying it to the ritual text, we're going to apply it to the Upanishads. And so, Vedanta is really, in a sense, an Uttara Mimamsa, is really a later Mimamsa, because it imports so much from Mimamsa that it then applies to the Upanishads to work with.
So the sacrifice, the ritual, it's prior to knowledge. By ritual, you become knowledgeable.
Okay, we'll get to that now. So I mentioned that one of the issues that all Vedantic authors have to deal with is the question, well, how does ritual practice relate to knowledge of the absolute knowledge of God? Different schools come up with different answers to that. Shankara says, well, Mimamsa, or the performance of ritual practice, is valid. It is something that works. So he's not like the Buddhist who will say that, why are you performing these rituals? It's unethical and so on. But he'll say, no, this is not a bad thing to do. It is something that will gradually purify you and you sort of restrain your desires and so on. But it is not ultimately good, he will argue. So in the long run, it's not the final thing. So it's valid, but not ultimately good. Shankara argues that Vedanta is in some sense a continuation of Mimamsa, but not in the sense that you need to go through ritual practice before you can come to knowledge. Shankara actually says no, they're complementary because they have two different spheres. And so ritual practice is here, knowledge is there, and the two are incompatible. That's Shankara's whole argument. The ritual practice is fine because it will sort of purify you. It will, you know, you can't sort of live a licentious life if you practice rituals. If you practice these Vedic rituals, because they're very elaborate and they sort of control your whole life, but they will not lead you directly to knowledge of the absolute. And so there's a sort of a break between these two. He says, my system of Vedanta is not contradictory to the system of Mimamsa, because they have two separate spheres. One is about this world, my system is about liberation. And so the two are incompatible, meaning that you can't do them at the same time, but they're not contradictory. That's his view. He argues that, and this is a theme that comes up again and again in Shankara's works. He said ritual practice cannot exist alongside knowledge, because knowledge means that you know you're not this body. You know you're the self within the body, and you're pure consciousness or pure awareness, and you're not the identities that you accumulate in this world. You're not, you know, father of such and such, or brother of such and such, or Brahman or Kshatriya or whatever. You're none of these things. You're not man or woman, but you're just the pure consciousness that's within. And so that's what the path of knowledge is all about, he says. Whereas if you go to ritual action, what you're doing there is you're constantly identifying with the body. When you perform an action, you perform a ritual action because you want to enjoy the results of that action. And so when you perform the action, you know, the enjoyment is the enjoyment of the body, so you constantly identify with the body. And so the two are incompatible. It's like lighting a fire and throwing water on the fire at the same time. He says you can't do the two at the same time. And so you have to give up ritual action in order to pursue the path of knowledge. The person we'll look at in just a moment, Ramanuja, he comes up with a very different way of seeing the relationship between Mimamsa and Vedanta. And in Ramanuja's tradition, Mimamsa and Vedanta are not seen as contradictory, or as incompatible. Ramanuja argues that ritual performance leads you to knowledge of the Absolute, leads you to knowledge of God. Ramanuja himself and later on in his school, they'll continually refer to the Upanishads, where all the sages that teach in the Upanishads are performers or Vedic priests, actually. If you read the Upanishads, they're all married people. Many of them have kids, and some of their disciples are their own sons. And all the teachers in the Upanishads are Vedic priests. And so they say, well, here are these people that teach us about Brahman, but they're performing rituals, so therefore there's no contradiction. You can do both at the same time. And Ramanuja's response to Shankara's argument that, well, the two are incompatible because ritual action strengthens your identification with the body, whereas knowledge sort of is supposed to reduce that identification with the body. Ramanuja's argument is that if you have the power of the knowledge is such that it will sort of overpower the influence of the ritual action, and so you can remain detached and you can remain sort of situated in knowledge while you're performing Vedic rituals. And so his argument is, in other words, twofold. On the one hand, Ramanuja says ritual performance leads to knowledge of Brahman. Like Shankara, he says it purifies you. But unlike Shankara, he says it's not that you have to give it up at some point and have to renounce ritual action in order to come to knowledge. Ramanuja argues that the ritual action in itself will lead you to knowledge of the Absolute, of Brahman. And so that's his first part of his argument. The second part of his argument is that once you have knowledge of Brahman, it is not that you have to give up ritual practice, but you can continue performing ritual practices. And the power of knowledge that you've obtained is so strong that it will override the influence of ritual action. So that's sort of a twofold argument. Ramanuja and the school that sort of flows out of him, particularly their if you read their works, much more than Shankara, they built very extensively on Mimamsa. In many places that are seemingly totally sort of alien to the ritual concerns of the Mimamsa, because they'll quote some Mimamsa passage, some Mimamsa rule of interpretation that they'll apply in a different context and so on. And so this is a school that really sees the Vedanta as a continuation of Mimamsa and really engages very strongly with Mimamsa. Shankara kind of says, well, yeah, Mimamsa is fine, but it's kind of over there and I'm over here and I'm doing the real thing, and that this is sort of a lesser thing. But Ramanuja and his school, they really see these two as complementary and as there's no conflict in their view. Now, Ramanuja, he lived in, he was born, I'll give you the date. These are the traditional dates given to him. So he was born in the 11th century, and he grew to be 120 years old. That's what tradition says. He was born near Kanchi, which is not too far from Chennai, in the Tamil region. And unlike some of the other people that we'll look at in the coming classes, and unlike Shankara, Ramanuja is really not a founder of a new school. And we'll see this in a moment. Ramanuja really comes in an already existing school, and there are a number of important teachers that we know and whose works we have that lived before him. And he sort of just joins that sort of converts to that tradition, if you want, but becomes the most prominent theologian in that tradition. But he's not the founder of that tradition. There's lots of stories about Ramanuja's life, as you can imagine. But there's one that I find very, very revealing and very interesting. And that is, Ramanuja is sort of, he's a young adult by this time, and he's married, and he lives his life in Kanchipuram, if I remember correctly. And anyway, he's living his life there, and he's already gained some reputation as a good teacher of Vedanta. But the head of the head of the Sri Vaishnava tradition, which is the tradition Ramanuja is associated with, it's a Vaishnava tradition, so their focus is Vishnu or Narayan, as they always call him, with Sri. Sri is Lakshmi. It's the consort of Narayana. And so that's their focus. It's they worship Sriman Narayana, Narayana with Sri. So the head of this tradition at his time was a person called Yamuna, or Yamunacharya. Yamuna was very old at this time of the story of when Ramanuja was sort of in his early 20s. And he was very old, and Ramanuja had wanted to meet Yamuna for a long time, but somehow it never actually happened. And Yamuna wanted to meet Ramanuja as well. He had heard stories of Ramanuja, and he thought, this is a person I really want to meet. This seems like a great person. And finally, Yamuna is traveling with his disciples, and he's near Kanchipuram, and he hears that Ramanuja is there. And so he sends one of his disciples. He says, go and get this Ramanuja. I want to meet him. And so this person goes, and he goes to Ramanuja and says, you know, Yamuna wants to see you. And he's delighted, you know, finally we can meet. But by the time he gets to where Yamuna has died. He's very old at that time, and he's passed away. And so Ramanuja arrives there, and Yamuna is dead, and of course he's devastated, and you know all his disciples are surrounding him, they're all devastated, but then Ramanuja notices that Yamuna's hand, his right hand, is like this, this is the head of the Sri Vaishnava order. Or the Sri Vaishnava community is just passed away, and all his disciples are around there. Ramanuja arrives and he sees Yamuna's hand is held like this, and the story goes that he sees this and he understands Yamuna's mind, and he says in front of the whole assembly, he says, I will write a commentary on the poetry, the Tamil poetry of the Alvar saints, which were Vaishnava saints that lived in the Tamil region in the centuries before. And when he said that, the first finger opened. And then he said, I will write a commentary on the Vedanta Sutra. And then the second finger opened. And then he said, and I will name one of my disciples after Parashara, the father of Vyasa, who's seen as the sort of the redactor of the Vedas. And then the third finger opened. And when that happened, the story goes that everyone sort of recognized Ramanuja as the legitimate heir of Yamuna. And so he was installed as the head of the community. But the story is significant because it really characterizes the system of Vedanta that Ramanuja develops. One of them is, of course, very Vedantic. He says, I will write a commentary on the Vedanta Sutra, which he did. And just to give you an idea of his commentary, this is his commentary on the Vedanta Sutra. It's a critical edition, so there's a little sort of textual critical apparatus at the bottom. But it's fairly long, as you can see. The Vedanta Sutra is 700 sutras long, most of which are the length of sort of Atharva Brahmavidyasa. So you have 700 sutras of that length, or just a few syllables. This is Ramanuja's commentary.
Sutras are like mantras?
No, they're just very short statements.
Sutras?
Yeah.
Mantra
is used ritually or in meditation.
Just one word?
No, it can be a whole verse, but it has a ritual use. Sutras don't. Sutras are actually just means of teaching something. They condense the material as much as possible so that they're easy to memorize. And there's sutra literally means thread, and so sort of they're meant as the threads that teachers can use to teach their disciples.
And where the mantras come from?
You have different types of mantras. You have Vedic mantras, you have tantric mantras.
You find them in Vedas and other
writings. So you find them in different texts. This is the first volume of Ramanuja's commentary. This is his commentary on four sutras. Ramanuja is not an easy author, and he assumes you know Shankara very, very, very well, because he has a go at Shankara at many places, and he assumes you know what he's talking about. This is his commentary on the first four sutras, which are, you might be able to Twitter them, the first four sutras. I mean, they might be less than 140 characters. And so he writes this very lengthy commentary. He also wrote a much shorter commentary. This is the Vedanta Sara, which is, again, it's a sort of a shorter commentary he wrote on the Vedanta Sutra. This is text with translation, so it's actually very short. For those that don't want to go through all that, maybe you thought, I'll write this short one. And this is his Gita commentary, which I'll just bring along. I like to show books because then you have an idea of how big things are. So that was the first, that's the sort of obvious thing he says, that I'll write a commentary on the Vedanta Sutra, which he does. He writes a commentary on the Gita. He never writes a commentary on the Upanishads. And in fact, Sri Vaishnavas, they only start writing commentaries on the Upanishads a couple of centuries later, and they only systematically do all the Upanishads only by the 14th, 15th century. But of course, Ramanuja has a lot to say about the Upanishads. He quotes the Upanishads left and right in his other works. So that was one of the promises, which is sort of an obvious one in a Vedantic context. But the other two are very significant as well. One is, he says, I will write a commentary on the poetry of the Alvars, which he actually never did, but he got his disciple to write that. And the poetry of the Alvars is Tamil poetry. It is not Sanskrit. Tamil is unlike a lot of the other modern languages in India. It's a classical language. It has a very long history. And this is devotional verses that were written by these various saints that lived in the Tamil region, and Ramanuja sort of brings these in and places them on an equal level with the Sanskrit texts. And in the Sri Vaishnava tradition, you get the notion of the Tamil Veda, and for them the poetry of the Alvars is on an equal level as the Vedic revelation and cannot be sort of seen in any lesser way. And so they've developed this strong Tamil culture. They start writing themselves works in Tamil. They start writing works in a mixture of Tamil and Sanskrit called Manipravala, Coral and Pearl. And so it's very different from any other school that you find. Shankara is only in Sanskrit, Madhva, who we'll look at tomorrow, next week, is only Sanskrit and so on. But here you have this very rich classical Tamil literature that's integrated into it, which also gives it, in a sense, a very regional character. It's Sri Vaishnavism never spreads very far beyond the Tamil borders because, a Kashmiri person doesn't know Tamil and so doesn't understand half of the literature of this tradition. And then the final promise he makes is, I will name one of my disciples after Parashara, the father of Vyasa. Parashara is associated with the Vishnu Purana. And the Vishnu Purana is central for Sri Vaishnavas. It's not just the Upanishads and so on that they quote, but they bring in the Vishnu Purana, which they see as an authority on an equal level as those texts. Unlike Shankara, who doesn't really engage with the Puranas at all and keeps himself just to the Upanishads and the Gita. Here you get this whole Puranic corpus of texts. Do you know what the Puranas are?
No.
Okay. The Puranas are a group of texts written in Sanskrit, generally fairly simple Sanskrit. They're often characterized as being the sort of the mythological texts of Hinduism, dealing with all the stories of the gods and so on. In reality, a number of these Puranas are very dense in theology, have a lot of theology. The Vishnu Purana is one of them. The other one is the Bhagavata Purana, which becomes a lot more popular in the north. They're these long texts. They're fairly long, actually. They're you have traditionally there's 18 Puranas that are listed, and they range in length from 10,000 verses to 80,000 verses. So they're very texts. So Ramanuja brings in the Vishnu Purana, and he quotes the Vishnu Purana. As often as he would quote the Upanishads. For him, this is an important source of theology.
They do not belong in any particular philosophical school. Purana, what is their role or place in the whole picture?
They generally have some sort of sectarian.
So you have some Puranas that
are really about Vishnu or Krishna, mm-hmm. And you have some Puranas that are about Shiva, and you have some Puranas that are a bit about everything. But the most important Puranas have a clear sort of sectarian affiliation. And so they're either Shaiva in orientation or Vaishnava in orientation, depending on what they focus on.
When were they written?
The Puranas? Mm-hmm. That's a difficult question. It really depends who you ask. Was it Ludo? I think it was Ludo Hoche, who was one of the biggest scholars of the Puranas. He said dating one of these texts is like putting up a bowling pin. You only put it up to knock it down again later. But they're generally dated. The earliest dates that people would give would be 3rd, 4th century BC, and the latest would be 12th century AD.
It's like the Bible.
Sorry?
It's like as old as the Bible.
Yeah.
The
Bible. But it's very hard to date these texts, largely because some of these Puranas are actually rewritten over the centuries. Like the Skanda Purana is one of the longest Puranas that we have now. But that text, as we know it, is actually a fairly recent text. And there was an older Skanda Purana that a group of scholars in Holland is working on. That is much shorter and of a very different character that just kind of disappeared and was replaced with this new Skanda Purana. And so things like that happen as well. So it's very hard to date these texts, actually.
So I have another question. If they were written over such a long amount of time and also talk about very different things and have different sectarian affiliations, why is there any sense of the Purana being like one body of texts?
Because they're similar in character. The structure of these Puranas is always the same. It's you have some sage who meets another sage and starts asking him questions, and then you get these long narratives and these stories within these. And it's predominantly stories, actually, but some of these Puranas are more or less purely stories and don't have a lot of theology in them. A Purana like the Vishnu Purana is very heavy on theology. And so it will tell stories, but then put in these theology lessons in these stories. You know, this sage meets this other sage and then teaches him about that. And so you get this long chapter on theology and so on. But in terms of their structure, they're all they're similar. And it's just that the Shaiva Puranas will say, well, Shiva is the supreme, and the Vaishnava Puranas will say, well, actually, Vishnu is the supreme. And they'll use similar stories for their own ends. So you have stories that occur inside of these Puranas that are just turned upside down in a Shaiva Purana or in a Vaishnava Purana and so on.
But Ramanuja hasn't been concerned with Puranas. He didn't study them.
The Vishnu Purana he really knows. The others, he quotes a number of the other ones, but not very often. Ramanuja is an author who is very conservative when it comes to quoting texts. He sort of has a group of texts that he really likes, and he quotes those again and again. Whereas other authors, like Madhva, we'll look at next week, he quotes a whole bunch of texts, including texts that no one else has ever heard of before. And so he's like all over the place in terms of his sources. Ramanuja is very, very narrow in his selection. And so, yeah, I mean, I don't know if he studied these other texts or not, but in any case, he doesn't quote them, at least not very often. Are you in a terrible rush, or shall I go a little over time and cover something of Ramanuja's ideas?
Okay.
We won't be kicked out of here. Ramanuja's teachings are called. Every Vedantic school comes up with their what they call a siddhanta, an anta, a conclusion that is siddha, that is established, and it's sort of a short phrase that encapsulates their theological position. And so Shankara's siddhanta is advaita, it is non-dualism, as you see last term. So he argues there's only one thing, that is Brahman, and Brahman is non-dual. It has no attributes which could create duality within Brahman, and so Brahman is just pure awareness, pure consciousness, without any attributes. And the world, Shankara says, kind of doesn't really fit into the picture because it's an illusion. And so it is not a separate entity in a sense from Brahman, because you've seen this last term, or so he says you cannot argue. Of course, his opponents say, well, you actually say the world is something separate, because you argue you cannot say that it does not exist, and you cannot say that it exists, and therefore you have this new category, this ontological category that you create, because Shankara argues that. The world is like a superimposition, is a superimposition on Brahman, like the idea of a snake is superimposed on a rope. If I'm walking to the house at night and there's a rope lying in the corner and I perceive that to be a snake, I superimpose the idea of a snake onto the rope. And so he says that the world is similarly superimposition onto pure consciousness, and it's an illusion. And he says the idea of the snake doesn't actually exist. I superimpose the idea of the snake onto the rope. And so he says, you cannot say that the world exists, you cannot say that the snake exists, and yet he says you cannot say that the world does not exist, the snake does not exist, because I perceive the snake and I respond to the snake in a particular way. So he says the world is therefore this sort of something in between, that it neither exists and yet you cannot say that it exists and you cannot say that it does not exist. And so he says it's sort of this separate ontological category. But Shankara's Siddhanta, Shankara's ultimate conclusion is Advaita, it's a non-dualism. There's only one thing that exists, and that is Brahman. Ramanuja doesn't like that and disagrees with this. And this Siddhanta is Vishishta Advaita. So it's an Advaita, it's a non-dualism that, and it's translated in different ways, it's a non-dualism that is Vishishta, that is qualified, or as Sri Vaishnavas themselves generally explain it, it is the non-dualism of he who is qualified. And I'll explain this now. And so Ramanuja's understanding is that he says that in one sense there is only one thing that exists, and that is God. God is the only thing that exists, but he says there's variety within God's existence. And so within God exists the world and the living beings, the selves that's us. And so we exist, we have our separate identity. He argues we're not ontologically, in a sense, the same as God. We have our individuality, we have matter is distinct from God. And yet we exist within God, and so in that sense we are part of his existence. He argues that the analogy he uses to explain this repeatedly is the analogy of the body and the self. And he says the relationship between God and the world and the living entities is the same, is similar to the relationship between the body and the self. And the self is God, and the body is the world and the living entities. And just as the body is fully dependent for its existence on the self, if I die and the self leaves the body, and he says then the body is no longer a body, and so it loses its identity, its existence. And so in the same way, the living entities and the world are fully dependent on God for their existence. The self controls the body just like God controls the world and controls the living entities. And the self exists for the pleasure of, the body exists for the pleasure of the self. I have a body in order to, you know, do certain things for myself, for the self. And so he says, in the same way, the living entities in the world exist for the pleasure of God. And so, therefore, he says that God is qualified by the world and the living entities. The relationship between the God and the living entities and the world is like the relationship between an object and its qualities. There is an Advaita, there is a non-dualism. So he argues that we cannot separate these two categories, God and living entities in the world, and God on the other hand, just as we cannot, you know, it's like this cap has the color blackness, the analogy he uses is of a rose or a flower. You have the flower, and the flower has a color, and he says you cannot extract the color from the flower and say here's the color and here's the flower. The two are inseparable. They cannot exist without the other. And yet, he says, yet they're different, because I can talk about the color of the flower and not about the flower as a whole. And so there's individuality within that existence of God, but they're inseparable. Does that make sense?
Yeah, this emphasis always in this discourse about differences. Indians have something with differences. This is different from that, this is from that, all the time. Is that true?
Yeah, we'll see next week. Madhva is really all about difference. Ramanuja will actually argue more for the unity of things. But his point is that Shankara argues for a unity of everything as well, but Shankara goes so far that he says, well, there's no individuality, even in the state of liberation. Ramanuja says, there is individuality, but yet there's a unity. And so when the Upanishads talk about the non-dualism of everything, he says they mean this, they mean that we have no existence separate from God. We cannot conceive of ourselves as being separate from God, and in that sense we are God, we are one with God, and yet I have my separate existence. And so that difference is very important for him. And it is particularly important for him because he's unlike Shankara, you know, his path is a path of renunciation and meditation. The path of Ramanuja is a path of bhakti, is a path of devotion. And so for devotion, you need a difference. You know, I worship a particular person, I love a particular person. And so he says there's that duality that is intrinsic, even in the state of liberation, he says. And the statements of the Upanishads that talk about that in the state of liberation you obtain the sameness as God, he means it means you obtain the same pleasure as God, and it means you are on in a way on an equal level as God, and you enjoy the same bliss that God experiences, but you have your own existence, you have your independent existence. Well, not independent, you're still dependent on him, but you have your individuality. That's his argument. Now, anyway, there's a lot more to Ramanuja than this, but I'll skip some of it. One important thing is that For Ramanuja, one thing that he stresses is that even when you obtain liberation, there's still dependence on God. And so he says there's servitude to God. You when you obtain liberation, you obtain the world of Vishnu, you obtain Vaikuntha, which is a world beyond this world, which is a world where if you want, you can take on any form you like. And so he does conceive of, I mean, Ramanuja, not just in terms of his analogies, but everything for Ramanuja is about embodiment. And he explains his whole theology through the image of embodiment, that the world is a body god. He talks extensively about the form of God. He argues God has attributes, but the attributes are non-different from him, unlike things in this world, and therefore there's this non-duality is not touched, and so on. But then one thing that Ramanuja talks about is a particular path that one can take, and it's a path that he calls... Prapatti, which means seeking refuge or surrender to God. And Ramanuja talks about this as a path of liberation, but his ideas are not entirely sort of clear, particularly how this relates to bhakti, which he conceives of as bhakti as worship of the murti in the temple, of meditating on certain mantras that are associated with the murti that you worship. And so it's a whole ritual practice. And he says, so you have bhakti, which is a ritual devotional practice on the one hand, and you have prapatti on the other hand, which is seeking refuge with God. And what happens in Ramanuja's tradition later on is there develops something of a schism. The schism is only really defined by the 18th century, but it's kind of building up until then. And what you get is you get a northern school and a southern school, and their differences are in two realms. One is their view of God, one is the view is their understanding of prapatti. The northern school sees a God as a compassionate person, but also a just person, so more like a just father who has affection for his children, but wants his children to do well, so institutes certain rules. And he sympathizes with the suffering of the living entities, like a father would with the suffering of his child, and he bestows grace upon the living beings. But the grace is not unconditional. You have to do something for it. So you have to act in the proper way, and then God bestows his grace. That's the northern school. The southern school says, no, it's not like that at all. And they say, God is a person who's full of love for his sons, the creatures. And they really use this language of son and father. And his grace is unconditional. There's nothing you have to do for it. He can bestow it as he likes. He does not demand you to act in a particular way before he bestows his grace. And they argue he not only, like the Northern School says, he sees the imperfections in us, but the Southern School actually says he does not only see it, but he enjoys the imperfections of the living beings. And more than that, he does not just sympathize with the suffering of the living beings, but he actually empathizes. He feels the suffering that we undergo in this world. And so it's a very different picture of God. And from that come the understanding of the relation of prapatti, of surrender. The Northern School says prapatti is a separate path. If you cannot follow the ritual practice of devotion, then you just seek shelter in God and just surrender to God. And that's a separate path for those that cannot do this for whatever reason, because they're born in the wrong family, you know, they're not, they haven't had a chance to be initiated in this practice, and they can just seek refuge with God. So prapatti is just another way of obtaining liberation. But even they say prapatti is a way of acting. It is something that you have to do. You have to act in a particular way. The Southern School, who has this view of God being sort of who's with unconditional grace and so on, they say, no, prapatti is the only way of attaining salvation. And unless you seek refuge in God, there will be no liberation for you. There will be no salvation. And they say prapatti is actually not an action at all. And I think Gavin talked about sort of the two ways that you can think of paths of liberation. At least that's what he told me, that he talked about last week. One is a sort of a gradual path that you fight for something, and one is sort of a sudden awakening to the truth. The Northern School is more sort of a gradual working towards something. The Southern School is really, they say, prapatti means you realize the Vishishtadvaita, you realize your full dependence on God, and that's all you need to do. And they say prapatti is not an action. As long as you continue to act and think that my actions will lead me to liberation, you're actually impeding the work of the grace of God. And so it is just an inner state that you develop. That's what prapatti is, and it's the only ways of liberation. Later you get the analogies that they use, where the Northern School is often called the monkey school, and the Southern School is the cat school, because the Northern School, they say, the way you obtain salvation is like a baby monkey who has to hold on to the mother, and the mother jumps from tree to tree and, you know, runs around, but the baby has to hold on. And so that's how we obtain salvation. We act, and when we act, when we hold on, then the God, who's the monkey, the mother monkey, brings us to our destination. The Southern School says, no, it's not at all like that. It's more like a cat who picks up the kitten in her sort of mouth, and the kitten doesn't, it's just helpless, doesn't do anything. And so the kitten is fully dependent on the grace of the cat to get where they want to go. And so that's the development that happens later in Sri Vaishnava tradition. It's a bit of a reading back, actually, I should say. If you look at some of the principal theologians that are now associated with the school, they kind of fall in both categories. But it's sort of, particularly in the 18th century, these differences are much more pronounced and become much stronger. Anyway, that's Sri Vaishnavism and Ramanujan in a nutshell.
Mimamsa, is it a theistic or non-theistic school?
In a sense, both. They argue against the existence of a God who creates this world and who's all-knowing and so on. They say that the idea... by the way, if you have to go, please feel free to go. I know I'm going over time. But they argue against the idea that there is a being who created this world, who's all-knowing and who's omnipotent, and all the characteristics that we associate with sort of a traditional understanding of God. So that's a ridiculous notion. There's no such thing. And they argue the world is eternal, it was never created, will never be destroyed, and just is ever existing. And so there's no need to say that there's a God who exists. At the same time, they do have all the Vedic gods that you perform sacrifices to.
Yes.
But even there, particularly, there's a figure before Kumarila, the biggest Mimamsaka theologian before Kumarila is a person called Shabara. And he goes at some length. He argues that he raises the question in his works that do the gods that are talked about in Vedic rituals, do they actually exist or not? And he develops this very complex argument that's partly very, I mean, it's very linguistic, where he says that his conclusion is that it doesn't matter. And he says the gods exist in the context of sacrifice. Because if I make, and what he means by that is, if I perform a Vedic ritual, there's an act that you make where you make an offering and you say, Idam Indraya Namama, this is for Indra, not for me, or Idam Agna, or whatever the deity that you offer it to. And so he says, if you believe that Indra actually does not exist, that act doesn't make any sense, because I say this is for Indra, not for me. And so he says, what you have to assume is that Indra exists within the context of the sacrifice. And he develops a whole linguistic and grammatical argument where he says that, Indra has to have some referent, otherwise this thing doesn't make sense. But the referent can be just the... I mean, he says, Indra can, if you just consider that Indra exists within the sound that I utter, I offer this to Indra, then that's fine, because then you'll still do the ritual. Whether Indra exists outside the context of sacrifice, he says it's irrelevant, it doesn't matter. And his opponent, he sort of has this you know, as Sanskrit philosophical texts generally work, he sort of raises an objection from a hypothetical opponent. And at the end of his very long argument, his hypothetical opponent says, but doesn't this mean that you just reduce the gods to their names? And that you know, the implications of your views are that the gods actually don't exist, and that they're just these names. And Shabara answers, he says, well, if that's the implication of my ideas, I have no problem with that, because it doesn't contradict the rest of my theology. And so even when it comes to the other gods, they're very reductionistic, you know, uh-huh. Sort of reduce them. For them, the central thing is sacrifice. They say, if I perform a sacrifice, it is not that Indra or Agni or whatever is pleased with me and says, oh, look at this guy, such a nice sacrifice he did, I'll bestow something upon them. He says, no, the power is in the sacrifice, not in the gods. And so the power is in the sacrifice, and the sacrifice compels the gods to act. In the places where he does talk about the gods, that's how he talks about them. And so the gods are really, I mean, he places the gods on the equal level as the spoon with which you make the offering into the fire. He says they're merely instruments for the sacrifice. You need the spoon to make the offering, but you also need a recipient for the sacrifice, so that's Indra, but they're on the same level, and they're not the goal of the sacrifice. The sacrifice is the goal in itself.
Yes.